Hello, space fans. Happy New Year, and welcome to another year full of Space Junk podcasts. In the first episode of 2022, Dustin and I talk about narrowband filters. What can they do for you? How do they work? What does narrowband filter even mean? And how can they help you take better astro images? Narrowband filters on this episode of Space Junk Podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Space Junk, a weekly podcast dedicated to the amazing hobby of amateur astronomy. Each week, we'll bring you interesting and fun discussions with an eye towards providing you with the latest information and advice on the tools, gadgets, software, and techniques for maximizing your enjoyment of the night sky. Your hosts are Tony Darnell from deepastronomy.space and Dustin Gibson from OPT Telescopes, a world leader in telescopes and accessories. Okay, everybody, Merry Christmas. We are in between holidays right now. We just had Christmas, looking forward to New Year's. Dustin and I have been anxiously going through a lot of family stuff, and now we're sitting down and we're going to snuggle in and talk about filters, multiband filters in particular, how to use them, what they're good for, and what they get you as an imager. And I think this is primarily an imaging thing, right, Dustin? Multiband filters?
Yeah, for the most part, because they're so narrow, they require long exposures, which are, you know, difficult to do with the human eye.
Yeah. So, using them, I think, is more or less an advanced activity, or at least an intermediate activity, right? If you're as an imager goes, right?
It adds a layer of complexity because as exposure time goes up, so does the chance, you know, during that time that anything else can go wrong. You know, the wind blows, you have to have good guiding, you have to have better tracking on your mount, you got to make sure the balance is right, polar alignment becomes more important. So all of those things go up, like the risk that something in your image can be off gets higher the longer you decide to push exposures. Now, granted, you know, for the most part, reward goes up as well as far as signal goes in an image when you decide to do longer exposures, especially with CCD. If you have CMOS, then it's true to a point. You know, pushing an hour-long exposure on a CMOS chip is not going to give you the same benefits that it might on a CCD. But still, with narrow band or multi-band pass filters, and we can start, you know, with what narrow band even really means, so that we can, you know, talk about picking apart the electromagnetic spectrum, specifically, you know, the visible wavelengths, picking them apart into very isolated chunks and sections, and why that would be beneficial, so that you can understand what you're getting with different light pollution filters, or, you know, now you see a lot of different marketing names, the multi-band filters. Ours has been called the triad, even though it's grown into what's actually a quad band pass filter.
Right.
You know, and then some of the less expensive ones that just say light pollution, right? So, you know, we can talk about where this idea kind of came from and how it works and what's required to really get the most out of it, regardless of which one you choose.
Let's definitely dive into that. But let me just say, so this, what we're going to be talking about today, folks, is something you want to consider getting into after you've kind of gotten your wings with just general imaging, right? Get comfortable with your mount. Make sure that you can track and find things and take decent images of things that without these filters, and then consider adding some of these things, because you don't want to just add one more variable to learn while you're learning all these other things. So look into this as you get more comfortable with your imaging career. And so, yeah, multi-band images or multiband filters are generally interference filters, right?
Yes. So they, you know, it's one of the things, and I want to preface this whole thing with this, because you're listening to this podcast right now, we are assuming that you want a deeper knowledge of these concepts than just this exists, go check it out, go buy it.
Right.
Photography in general is a hobby that rewards people for understanding exactly how their system works on a deeper level. And not all hobbies work that way. You know, like video games, for instance, the more time you just spend playing, generally you get better at it. photography, when you really want to get proficient, you really want to take it to the next level, you need to understand what F-ratios are and how to take your camera off of that automatic button and switch it to manual. And once it's there, most people never, ever touch automatic again because the reward is too high for taking control and taking ownership of the image at every level once you have that understanding. So we're assuming that's where people listening to this podcast want to be, is that they want to do astrophotography truly on the manual setting, right, with every component that they own. So we're going to go into filters on quite a bit of a deeper level. But, you know, now that that's out of the way, let's talk about...
Yeah, no, this was well said. That was well... I'm glad we established that because, yeah, we're going to dive into something that is... once you understand it, once you implement some of the techniques that we talk about here today, you will improve with your astrophotos. So, yeah, well said.
Well, let's start here, Tony. I think this is the best place to start is the foundational level. Let's do this whole thing construction through reduction, chemistry style, right?
Sure. Like,
let's break it apart. So I'm going to ask you for the very quick, we're riding up an elevator. Can you give me a physics lesson on what the EM spectrum is and where visible light falls within that?
Okay, so... Sure. The electromagnetic spectrum is quite large, and I don't have the numbers memorized in my head, but they range anywhere from very long, multi-meter long wavelength radio waves, all the way up through the microwaves, and then infrared wavelengths, all the way through the visible band, which is a very, actually very narrow, tiny slice of the entire electromagnetic spectrum, all the way up from UV to the high energy X-rays, gamma rays, and cosmic rays that are at the very high frequency end of the spectrum. When we look up at the sky with our telescopes, we are concentrating on the optical band of that much larger frequency range, and it tends to go from about 400 nanometers, 4,000 angstroms on the high end toward the blue, all the way down to about 6,500 angstroms or 650 nanometers, which is toward where the red part is. Those are wavelengths, very tiny wavelengths, but those are the ones that we can generally see. And the atmosphere acts as a really huge interference filter because it interferes with most of that light. Most of the everything past ultraviolet does not get through our atmosphere. It blocks it. It's filtered out. Everything below, say, the near infrared, which is about a half a nanometer, is blocked out. What did I just say? I said a half an angstrom, right? So... right. So that would be, that's the near infrared. That would be blocked out, everything down until about the radio wavelengths, which lets the atmosphere through, lets those wavelengths through again. So we have these bands. We have the biggest interference filter of all, which is the atmosphere, blocking out most or a significant portion of the entire electromagnetic spectrum. That's a good thing, because if those high energy photons got through the atmosphere, we would die. So it's good that they're not being allowed through. So everything we now look at with our telescopes is in this narrow band. But we still want, even though the atmosphere lets all of that through, there's still other things that get in the way, like the atmosphere and other things that we want to also eliminate so that we can get only at the wavelengths where individual objects in space are either emitting light or reflecting light so that we can see them. And that's what filters allow us to do. And I say interference, let me just say that when you make an interference filter, you're making a little miniature atmosphere, right? You're putting a coating on a piece of glass whose specific job is to block out certain wavelengths of light. It interferes with those wavelengths and rejects them, doesn't let them through. And then the more coatings you put on that filter, the more wavelengths you're able to select and block out until you're only left with the wavelengths you care about. And that's the kind of filter that Dustin and OPT has made with the triad filter, which we'll go into in more detail. But that's sort of what we're doing with the electromagnetic spectrum and what these filters are giving us. They're allowing us to see and allowing our detectors to get photons, only the photons that we care about and nothing else. How's that?
Right.
Is that okay?
No, that's excellent. That's excellent. Yeah. And the main point that I want to get at is that, you know, you've got a lot more to light than just the light that our eyes are sensitive to. And so when we talk about the visible spectrum, that what we're saying is visible to our eyes, right? But, you know, these wavelengths are definitive. So when you're looking at the width, like you're talking about it and, you know, you're quantifying with the exact numbers, these numbers are defining that wavelength as maybe specifically infrared. Or even within the visible spectrum, red or blue, if we would just want to keep it super general.
That's right.
What you're not going to find is those exact wavelengths that somehow end up being the wrong color. So it's the exact same wavelength as blue, but now is somehow red. That's not the case unless that wavelength gets stretched and now is longer through something like red shifting, then it would be defined as red. So these are definitive. These wavelengths are definitive. And so because of that, we can find particular wavelengths that we're trying to isolate to either pass through or to keep out. And that's really what we're talking about with these filters, is making sure that the light that's coming through to our sensors, which are more sensitive to wavelengths beyond what our eyes can see than our eyes are, right? So making sure that we're only allowing to pass through the signal that we actually want to keep. And that's, you know, it's challenging. It's not something, it's easier said than done, because we've done a really good job of making the night sky very hard to see as a species.
Hey, you know, that's for sure.
We've put lights up everywhere, all around the globe. If you look at a light pollution map, it's a very beautiful image. If you're not an astronomer, if you are an astronomer, it's one of the scariest things you can ever see. And then, you know, the first time I saw it was actually before I was into astronomy. And what hit me was just the progress of humanity. I was like, wow, this is incredible. Like, humanity, look at all this. This is, no other animal could have done this. And it was not something that I saw as just this terribly negative thing. Then you start trying to do astronomy. You're like, where do I go to see the night sky? You know? And it's a challenge, but you have to block that stuff out if you live in a city or if you live anywhere. And even if you don't live in a city, you're still going to have light pollution from the surrounding cities unless you're really far away in a really isolated area or, you know, up on top of the perfect mountain type of thing going on. And so did you have something there, Tony?
I just wanted to ask you, with that in mind, given how the night sky has become so bright, and it's rapidly ruining a visual observer like myself to use eyepieces. Do you think that one can still be a good astrophotographer without trying to filter this out? Do you need filters to take decent astrophotos?
Yeah, I still see people doing it with just RGB, you know, in RGB. So the only filters being red, green, and blue, which is not a narrow band filter, not a light pollution filter at all, or even just going and grabbing a Canon camera from the store down the street, throwing it on the back of a telescope and doing imaging from cities. I see that all the time. And people are still doing incredible work. Obviously, it pays to get under dark skies if you're not going to be using light pollution filters. And then if you're under dark skies, they're really not necessary. If you are in a really bright city, like for instance, when we went to Times Square together, you remember that and did the imaging, there'd be no way. It would be impossible just to attach a, you know, a off-the-shelf camera to the back of a telescope and try to get images of a nebula or something faint in space. There'd just be absolutely no way. But that's a very extreme example. If you're on in the suburbs of some city and you want to take a picture of something brighter like Pleiades or the Orion Nebula, you can absolutely do it. And then if you're really good at processing, you can make these images incredible, even from, you know, technically being within city limits. Where these filters really come in handy is when you're trying to take advantage of every night. You want to be able to shoot when the moon is out. You want to be able to block out that light pollution. To whatever degree you have it, and you want to get the maximum amount of signal you possibly can onto the chip that you have, onto the sensor that you own, and really try to push your imaging as far as possible. So it's not that you have to. It's just this is the next step. Yeah. This is the next step in the evolution of, you know, pushing your photography if you haven't already started shooting narrowband or, you know, through filters. This is generally the next step people take to push their signal further.
Okay. Let's make the distinction between broadband filters and narrowband then. We're going to be talking about narrowband primarily, but you just brought up RGB. So what's the difference between a broadband filter and a narrowband filter?
Yeah, so people think of like RGB filters as something that I get asked this question on Instagram regularly, but they think of it as something that's kind of like a narrowband filter, and it's really not. RGB filters are what already exist on your iPhone, on your Canon, on anything that shows you color images. They have over every single pixel a red, green, or blue filter, and it generally is in a pattern that repeats RGGB over and over again. It's called a Bayer matrix, and that's how it gives you a color image. It looks at which ones register how much light. They know that light should be assigned to that color, and then they guess at the spaces in between on, you know, if it's a green filter and then they're, you know, the red filters around it are picking up a lot of light, they can assume there should be some red light where those green filters are, even though the green filters can't pick it up. It's called interpolation.
Right.
And so an RGB filters, red, green, and blue filters are called broadband filters. And it's because they let in a very wide pass of wavelengths. Everything that we would contain within the red part of the spectrum would be a red filter. It's still going to keep out blue and green, but it allows you to pass all of the red wavelengths at one time. The difference being narrowband is going to be a very, very small chunk of one of those. So like, for instance, hydrogen alpha is a very, very, very tiny, just miniature spot of the red wavelength. It's not going to allow all the rest of the red to come through. It's only going to allow specifically light that's coming from ionized hydrogen at that wavelength to pass through, which is a really good thing because it means if your street lamp is not putting off that very specific wavelength, but it is putting off red light, that red light that it's putting off isn't going to hit your chip. But the, you know, the emission nebula that you're shooting out in space still will. So that's why you narrow it down even more from red to specifically sulfur or hydrogen, so that you can isolate out other things. You want to keep out the car light driving by or some of the moonlight that's getting into the image, those sorts of things.
Yeah. And as you pointed out, and a narrow band filter, by contrast, has a much narrower amount of wavelength ranges it lets through, right? By definition. So What are we looking at width-wise? So a narrow band filter, red, for example, might be between 650 and 550nanometers, so about 100, maybe 100 nanometers or 1,000 angstroms wide. How wide would a narrow band filter be?
They go down to about 3 nanometers.
So there's your difference, folks. Several orders of magnitude of light is cut out. Even though it's red, like hydrogen alpha, as you just pointed out, that's at 65, 62 angstroms, plus or minus one angstrom, right? So that's where that wavelength range is. So filters that don't see anything else outside of that aren't showing you H alpha and aren't showing you the detail at that wavelength. They're showing you all other things as well. So this is the difference between the two kinds of filters.
Yeah, it's very specific. And so when we're talking about narrowband filters, you know, just think of broadband is the whole color. Narrowband is a narrow sliver of that color.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's good.
And then, you know, they start at about 12 nanometers when you look at narrowband filters. Like if you want a hydrogen alpha filter, is the most common. They start at about 12 nanometers. The best filters are 5 nanometers or 3 nanometers. You know, it's people go back and forth because nitrogen is so close to hydrogen, people will do 5 nanometer filters so that they can pass both through the filter. And, you know, even though it opens the door slightly to a little more light pollution to get in, it's not really significant, but it does allow nitrogen to pass through. So if you're shooting something like planetary nebula, you get the benefit of that. If you're just a signal junkie, that's all you care about is just getting the maximum amount of signal you possibly can, then people go with 3 nanometer filters where they can completely control their images. Because you could always add a 3 nanometer nitrogen filter later too, and then just completely control what light comes into your images. So that's where the people really trying to push for, you know, the ultimate in image control generally go is 3 nanometer filters. But filters get very expensive as they pass through this. And you know, you mentioned earlier, you can add a lot of coatings. Adding coatings is not something that's cheap at all, especially when they have to be that specific. They have to be that refined that they're only passing 3 nanometers or 4 nanometers of light. And then you're talking about adding multiple of those. So they have to be extremely thin in order to keep transmission. How much light can actually pass through of the specific wavelength you want?
What can someone who is looking at various filters and trying to compare or find out whether one filter is good versus, like, am I looking at a quality filter? What are the things that a prospective person can look for to know if that filter, published data, that that filter is good or maybe not so good? I think price is probably one. You know, what if it's price expensive, it's probably pretty good. But, you know, what else can somebody look at?
There are a lot of indicators. Price is going to be a big clue. Like, I can tell you, for instance, the Triad filter. Or if you're looking at narrowband filters, like take something like Chroma or Astronomique. I would put these at the very top of, you know, the game as far as like who's making filters which are really high transmission that are just consistent every single time. They're not going to produce halos. They're not going to have these other artifact issues. They're not going to come with terrible transmissions on one, but then the next one's a really good copy. It's just repeatable, performance every single time. I'd say that those types of filters, and there are others, but I'd say those are at the top of their game, and they are more expensive, especially Chroma. Chroma is going to be a lot more expensive, American-made, and just really sets the bar for filters globally right now. And in the past, there were other American-made companies doing it extremely well, too. But, there have been some quality issues that have been raised. We stopped selling several brands over that stuff. Too many returns, too many issues, and just things that, you know, couldn't be explained away. So we just stopped for trying to represent things that obviously couldn't hold to the standards that had been set or that people were hoping for. But those always do. And so looking at that, I'd say that's kind of where the bar is set. And then from there, you see price go down. And the reason price goes down is that it's not that everybody's making the filters for the same cost. And some companies are just like, well, we're just going to charge more so we can make more. It's simply that the filters cost drastically different amounts to make depending on the tolerances that the company's trying to produce. So if you're going for something that is exactly 3 nanometers, it's going to be 3 nanometers every time. It's going to be on band every time. Where, right? It's one thing to say it's 3 nanometers, but we missed hydrogen alpha entirely and still call it a hydrogen alpha filter. Like that's a very different conversation than this is hydrogen alpha at 3 nanometers every single time, and it's going to have a transmission of 90-95% or more every single time, compared to a filter that's a third of the cost, that's a 12 nanometer filter, and, you know, plus or minus 2 nanometers, and transmission rates of, you know, uncertainty. You don't know. Doesn't mean the filter's bad at all. And I'm telling you that this conversation 5 years ago, I would have just said, stay away from a lot of really cheap filters. I used to say this all the time. Do not put bad glass in front or behind your good glass. Don't do it. Don't go buy a really nice telescope and then put one little piece of glass behind it that becomes a limiting factor of your system. Do not do it. You're wasting your good telescope on a bad filter.
Yeah, that's really good advice.
But now it's not the case. I mean, even the inexpensive filters have gotten so good. Companies like Optolong have brought it through just tremendously, done a really good job of lifting that side of the filter world up. And they're not the only ones. They're just, you know, one I'll mention here that have brought costs down. But the filter quality, I mean, they're not trying to be a Chroma. They're not trying to say this is the best filter in the world. They're trying to say this is a really great value.
Yeah.
And it's two completely different things.
What do you think did that? Why do you think that's happening? Why? Is it scale? They're just able to make more of them, and so the price goes down. I mean, what do you think's changed?
On everything gets better over time. Like as as technology gets better, you know, being able to produce things more consistently goes up with it. And so these filters, even though they're not going, like I said, they're not going to be chroma 3-nanometer filters. They're not going to be filters without any issues at any time. And, you know, they may produce things like halos or other things that, you know, chroma wouldn't stand for. It's not meant to be that. It's meant to be a filter that is half the price or a third of the price. And so it's two completely different takes on the same project. One is saying, let's see how we can provide really, really great value as far as getting something in that doesn't break the bank for somebody that just wants to test, wants to check out narrowband filters or wants to, you know, they're not going to, this isn't their life, right? This is a hobby that they're enjoying and they want to push to the next level, but they don't want to go spend $1,000 on a filter, right? And that's a huge percentage of the population. And I would say it's a really good service to the community to have those options. The other side of the world, the chroma stuff is where you're serving the community that says, this is something, this is my favorite thing in the world to do. I live for astronomy. It's like, it's part of what I am. It's part of what I do. And I want the best because I've already invested so much in my telescope. I have a really nice camera and I want to have a one and done solution that I know with confidence is not going to be a limiting factor in my system in any way. I want to be the best thing you can do as an astronomer is yourself. Have your equipment be so good that you are the problem in your images, right? You want to be the limiting factor in your images. And that's where chroma lives is, you know, and I really shouldn't just say them because there are other, like I would say Astronomiques right there too. Like they do a really, really great job of pushing those boundaries. They just don't, you know, they're not going to produce the 3-nanometer stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, getting to those levels is where you can say, like, I know my filter is not the problem. Like, I am the limiting factor in my images. And that's really where you want to be. But it's two different things serving two different types of shoppers.
How much do your images suffer, would you say, when you're using one of the value filters versus one of the top of the line? Is it comparable? I mean, I don't know what the value filter ranges go, but let's say it's $500 versus $1,000 for a top of the line. Do my astro images suffer by half or is it not quite that linear? Do I take twice as worse of an image with a value filter than I would with the top of the line?
It can depend. And it depends on brand. It depends on the consistency of, you know, the manufacturer. But what I would say is that when you go with one of these expensive brands, what you could do is you could take that filter out of your system. You could go swap it out with someone else that has the same exact filter in Chile and another person that has the same exact filter in Australia. And you would not be able to tell the difference. No matter where you took it in the world and you swapped it with anyone else that has the same exact filter, you would not be able to tell the difference. That cannot necessarily be said about all filters and all brands.
I see.
And so what you're paying for is that consistency and that confidence that this is going to do exactly the same thing every time it's made, or else it just simply won't pass and it won't ever hit the shelf. The other side of it is, like, if you look at some images with, let's take the, you know, instead of the $1,000 range or the $300 narrowband filter, you take the narrowband filter that's $100 and you look at images with it, one thing you're going to see is that typically the stars will look, they won't look as tight. They might look a little more bloated and have little halos around them. That's a really common issue with less expensive filters, is that the transmission is such that, you know, the stars develop halos around them. And I don't even think it looks bad, but it's something that if you're a really, you know, critical processor, it's going to drive you nuts.
And you can also get rid of that with processing too, if you wanted to take the time.
To a degree, it's tough because the halos can be pretty large and pretty bold on the images. But it's those types of things. It doesn't mean that you're not going to be able to get signal, But it does mean that you're going to have to work harder for it than you will with something that's just going to replicate the same image every single time and truly be 3 nanometer compared to like 12. You know, there's just a huge difference between 3 and 12 nanometers about how much even light pollution comes in. And you see, so let's take, for example, because I don't want to make this convoluted and I feel like I'm doing a bad job of explaining it.
No, I think it's very good.
Okay, so let's take the Triad, for instance. When we made the Triad, we didn't know if it was going to work. In fact, I was positive it wouldn't work. But it just seemed like one of those crazy ideas that one of our team had that we were like, let's do it, you know? And after it did work, the original Triad was 3 passes, but 2 of them were blended together. So technically it was like two passes, but one of them was like kind of this dual pass. It allowed two wavelengths that we wanted to come through together, but also, you know, that wasn't really the idea that we ultimately wanted to do. It was just the first one of its kind. They're really hard to manufacture. That's why it hadn't been done to that point. That and everybody thought it was a crazy idea that would be expensive to produce and would, you know, have no positive result in the end. That filter now has been copycatted. I bet there's 25 different versions out there of people claiming that it's like the same kind of thing.
Wow.
And I think it's excellent. And each time, especially with the reputable companies, they've contacted me and asked, are you okay if we do this? We didn't patent anything we did intentionally. For one, it didn't seem like it would make much sense because, you know, we didn't know that this would work, first off. And secondly, if it does benefit the hobby, this is a hobby. Right. This is a hobby and something that should be pushed forward. And it's really just something that we kind of wanted. Like, I want to use this, right? But we weren't trying to make this filter and every variation of this filter possible. We were just trying to make this filter. And so other people took it and we always tell them the same thing. Yeah, go make it. Go make it. It's not an easy thing to do. But what ends up happening instead is they're like, well, we're not going to make that, but what we are going to do is we're going to make a multiple bandpass filter that one of them might be 6 nanometers and the other one is going to have sulfur and hydrogen beta or whatever it is, but it's going to be, you know, 16 nanometers, right? It's going to be wide. So it allows 2 different channels to come through, but, you know, when you put it all together, if you put them side by side, they don't look anything like each other. What makes the Triad Ultra, you know, still the most in-demand filter that we have, even at, you know, a price point that is much, much higher than anything else of its kind, 3 times higher than anything else, you know, is because, I mean, it was very, very expensive to produce, which is what drove that price point. It still is. We lose a lot of the ones that are produced, to be honest. They're made on this big sheet. And if you get the sheet and it doesn't match those specs, the sheet is gone, but it still had to be paid for to produce. And those filters are not cheap to make.
Yeah.
Which is what drives these prices. And the tighter the, you know, the tolerances that you're going for, the more likely you are to lose them. And that's the piece that people don't see behind the scenes. It's very, very challenging. So what people do instead is they say, let's just make them where we can still market as a multiple bandpass filter, but just not push for those types of tolerance. Let's not have 4 individual narrowband filters on one filter, which is what the Triad is. It's 4 nanometers across 4 different filters, all on the same filter. So if you were buying those filters independently, they'd be $300 to $400 a piece, right? So roughly $1,600 filter, because it's got hydrogen alpha at 4 nanometers, sulfur 4 nanometers, hydrogen beta at 4 nanometers, and oxygen 3 at 4 nanometers. If you buy those independently, it's going to be very expensive. They're all on the same filter. There is no other filter doing that or anything close to that. Still now, there's nothing even remotely close to that. There are filters that are doing a really, really great job at multiple bandpass and light pollution prevention in images. I think Optolong, their L-Extreme, is doing a killer job. It's like taking the same idea and going about it two different ways. One is, again, that model of how do we just make it the one and done, best possible solution. I know if I buy this and I put it in my imaging train, there is nothing else to buy ever, right? Like that's what the Triad Ultra filter was meant to be. So that's why we didn't look at it and go, hey, how do we make this thing in a way that we can get cost down to the lowest possible thing? Because it's not, you can't have everything, right? Like there's no way to produce it and make it $50. I wish there was, because I would do that today, right? But there's just no way to do that. You have to sacrifice somewhere. And if you want that quality, you have to sacrifice on the cost side. And so that's what we did with that one, where the other ones are doing a phenomenal job is saying, we're not going to make that filter. But what we are going to do is we're going to make a really inexpensive filter that does maybe 60% of that job and gives people those benefits, but it's also only 60% of the cost, right? And so like that's the trade-off. And I think it's one hell of a trade-off. I think it's awesome. I think it's great, yeah, man. And it allows people, and there are filters that, let's say it's 30%. It costs 30% of what the Triad does, but it gives you maybe 30 or 35% of the benefit. Like shit, that's great too. Yeah. I love that too, because then people can choose, like, how much do you want to invest and how much do you really care that it performs to this level? If you're a brand new astrophotographer and you can't tell the difference, do you really need to go spend $1,000 on a filter if you don't know what you're even looking for or how to use it and you're just trying to get started? Probably not. Go buy the $150 one. You know, go buy the Universal Astro one. It's like perfect for just general light pollution suppression at a tenth of the cost. Go do that. And you're going to be much, much happier starting out there than trying to use 4-nanometer filters where you have to do really long exposures because the wavelengths are so narrow that you're blocking out 99% of the very limited light you're getting in the first place.
Yeah, let's move to that. I want to talk a little bit about how to use these filters once you've got them, and why you want to. And let me just say a couple of words about that real quick. The objects in the night sky that we're interested in imaging, whether they be galaxies, nebulae, planets, whatever they happen to be out there, either reflect or emit light in certain wavelengths. And depending on the object you're looking at, a different filter would be advantageous. For looking at the moon, for example, a nice polarizer would help you get some detail and contrast out of something that would be very overwashed and very, very narrow dynamic range. Something like the planet Saturn would benefit from some maybe broadband filtering, things like that. But other things, like nebulae in particular, a nebula like the Orion Nebula, which is a stellar nursery. It's got stars being born there. It's emitting light in, at the brightest anyway, at certain wavelengths, I don't know what they are off the top of my head, but oxygen, most nebulae tend to emit at the wavelengths Dustin already mentioned, oxygen 3, sulfur, hydrogen alpha, hydrogen beta. These are all wavelengths that these nebula tend to emit, and they're called emission nebula because they do that. Other nebula are reflection nebula. They don't really shine on their own, but they reflect nearby radiation from something else, and that would require different kinds of filters. So you get the most contrast and image quality, or I should say the signal that you want from these very faint objects by selecting the appropriate filter. That's why you want them. But yeah, how to use them? Let's talk about that a little bit, Dustin. What advice do you give for someone who's just got a brand new narrowband filter?
Yeah, so a couple of trade-offs. When you're going narrower, and I know that everything I've said to this point says, go as narrow as you can possibly afford if you want to just buy it and be done. Do that, right? Here's the trade-off. If you live in a really, really dark area, you already live out in West Texas and you have no light pollution as it is, and you're really just looking for time to shoot when the moon is out, it may not necessarily be needed for you or beneficial in the sense that the narrower you go, and something that I know you're hinting at now, Tony, is that the narrower you go on your filter, the longer your exposure has to be. And right, so if you're shooting broadband, let's say that you want to shoot just red as a channel. And I actually do this. So I shoot very, very long exposures. Most people now are shooting 2 minute exposures or 5 minute exposures. My exposures for every single image I take, sub exposures anyway, are at minimum 10 minutes each. And when I'm shooting narrowband, and that's my color channel, so luminance, R, G, and B, I always shoot 10-minute exposures unless it's a target that is just overwhelmingly bright, then I'll cut that down. But the standard, I mean, I literally have this set as the standard to where my automated system doesn't even ask me anymore. It just runs 10 minutes on LRGB and then 30 to 45 minutes for every single image of hydrogen, sulfur, or oxygen. And that's for each sub exposure. So ultimately, like when I'm done with an image, it might have 40 or 60 hours of image data in one picture, you know, which is a lot. It's a lot of time. But because the system's automated, it runs most of the time while I'm sleeping. So it's not, you know, a huge cost to sit up with it. But, you know, that's how narrow those filters are. I mean, 3-nanometer filters, you know, I'm doing really long exposures. And even with, and I'm using an old CCD sensor, but even with the new CMOS stuff, the hypersensitive things like the 6200, people are still, instead of doing 5 minute exposures, if they're going that narrow, they're doing 10 minute exposures, you know, which is a lot of time commitment to get that extra signal. But you have to remember, the narrower you go, the more light you're keeping out. And so you're not getting that light as quickly. So how to shoot them is, keep in mind that, you know, you have to adjust your exposure time based on how narrow a filter you bought. And then you got to select your target. And, you know, different types of targets you just mentioned, you know, clusters, globular clusters, open clusters, those types of things, galaxies of different types, you know, nebulae of different types. Let's just break it down to reflection and emission. And then planetary, where you're going to shoot the moon or, you know, different planets. And really the place that these types of filters are going to excel is on one very specific type of all of those things we just mentioned, which is emission nebula. The rest are challenging. You can still shoot especially bright galaxies like Andromeda, M81, M82, those things. You can still shoot those with narrowband filters and get a benefit, or even the triad filter. I've seen a lot of really incredible images of Andromeda with the triad filter. But it's not going to pay the reward that it will for something that it's really designed for. And the only thing it's really designed for is emission nebula, which are those big, bright, beautiful. I mean, when somebody thinks, hey, spout off a few nebula, not everybody, but most people are going to say the ones that everybody knows and everybody's come to love. They're going to say Horsehead, usually right out of the gate, because it's, right, in my opinion, one of the most incredible, only topped, I think, by the Rosette. The Rosette Nebula, in my opinion, is the greatest nebula of all time.
I'd agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is cool.
It's like, yeah, it's unbelievable no matter what. You can look at it visually, it's incredible. You look at it, you know, you take pictures of it, it's incredible. The just the shape, like the story, the whole thing is just amazing. But then the Orion Nebula is another one. Everybody knows the Orion Nebula because it's where we all start. And that's another one that is an emission nebula. But going through them, you know, you've got the cone. You've got Barnard's Loop, which is almost exclusively hydrogen. Okay, so the Crescent Nebula would be another one. And on and on. I mean, when you're going through the night sky, you're going to find all of these different nebulae, all of the big, bright, colorful ones that you see, all the beautiful images of, they're typically going to be those emission nebulae. Generally, when you see the really bright blue ones, you get a lot of reflection nebulae. Things like the Witch's Head or, you know, even things that people want to shoot that, you know, just aren't emission nebula, like Pleiades. Pleiades, you can't shoot it with the triad filter and get the results you're looking for with all of those, that bright blue dust that's seen in between the stars there. It's, you know, it's an incredible thing to shoot, but it's not going to be something that produces great images with these types of filters. So you really want to go after emission nebulae specifically to get the best results from these types of filters.
Awesome. And So I guess I'll say a few words about what would be cool if you had one of these filters and you cared about science instead of just imaging. One of the things that astronomers care about with these filters is their they characterize them based on their wavelength width, like we just talked about, their bandwidth, their bandpass, and their transmissivity. And then they calibrate them so that when they look at a certain frequency for a long or wavelength for enough period of time, that is modeled to an irradiance, a flux that comes out from those nebulae. Now that may not be important, but if you really want to measure the brightness of a star, for example, you can do that independently of just looking it up. The Hubble Space Telescope, for example, the band passes in the infrared that it uses is anywhere from 300 nanometers wide, which is pretty wide, to about 70 nanometers wide, depending on the wavelength. But this is infrared, right? So this is hard to image no matter what. And when it looks at something in the infrared, it can tell you, well, I've gotten this many, you know, my pixel says 5,300. And that value actually means something. It means luminosity. It means ergs or energy or whatever unit it happens to be. You can do that with these filters yourself. You got to do some math. You got to figure out the details of your filter. Just get the published data on it. And you can characterize, gee, when I expose my star, whatever it is you're looking at, let's say Betelgeuse, for so many length of time, you get a certain detector count on your CCD. You can convert that into ergs or, you know, luminosity with yourself. And this is important if you're studying variable stars, especially since lately Betelgeuse has been varying in brightness. So this is the kind of activity you could get into if you cared about it enough to learn the science behind it as well. Filters are impossible. It's impossible to do professional science, I should say, without them. So it's an endeavor you can embark on if you are so inclined mathematically or just scientifically you want to learn about this stuff. So I just want to put that out there.
I've never seen, you know, we do a lot of business in the professional space, and I can honestly say I've never seen like a large order for a university other than for outreach. Just for, you know, public outreach, I've never seen an order for things like color cameras, you know, that were going to be used scientifically.
Yeah. That's a whole episode, which we're going to look at next year, CCDs versus CMOS. There's a reason why astronomers, professional astronomers use CCDs over CMOS cameras, although that is changing somewhat in certain use cases.
A lot of them have been discontinued.
Yeah,
you know, you have to go with what's available or produce it yourself, which is still being done actually probably more now than before, because, you know, with the 16803 going away and the 5100 at the same time, and a few others, you know, the 9000 and a few other chips, it makes it really challenging for the people that had built a lot of their systems around the idea that these would be available, and then all of a sudden they weren't. And the CMOS cousin to those just isn't there yet, you know. Like the Kepler 4040 is not the 16803. It's not the same thing. The CMOS version and the CCD, even though they have the same specs on paper, they are not the same thing. And so we should do an episode on those and talk about the differences.
Yeah, we'll do that next year coming up, which is just next week. So, all right. Well, we've covered quite a bit about these filters. Is there anything that you could think of we've missed? Let's see. There's why you need them, what they give you, value versus top of the line, how they work. I don't know. I can't think of any. Can you?
Let me ask you this. Do you use filters visually? I know you can't use imaging filters because they're too narrow. You know, the human eye, you can't control exposure times. But they do still have a, you know, a tremendous benefit, especially with a scope the size you have. Do you use filters?
No. What I want, though, is a polarizer. I really want to get a filter that I can just put on the eyepiece that helps me view the moon better. But just a really super broadband, light pollution filter. That's about it. I don't use them much.
Your telescope is half a meter, and I think it's F4 or F4.5. Yeah. That's a lot of light to be looking at the moon without a filter.
No, you can't really. I mean, I tend to do first crescents, right? The early crescent moons, and that's about it. I don't go anything up to half, even half moons. So it's just no point. I get a smaller scope out and do it. Where that gets me, obviously, where I get all of my bang is in aperture on faint objects. You know, the Crab Nebula is, you know, easily twice as bright, three times brighter in that in my eyepiece than any other telescope. So I get way more photons. So that's what I'm getting out of it, and that's you know, imagers can get away with these small apos, right? You know, they can get these small apos because they can just compensate by doing longer exposure times. Visual observers can't do that. We've got to have aperture to be able to see anything worthwhile. So, but you know, like I said, I could benefit from a good polarizer, I think, maybe a light pollution filter, but that's it. I don't really want any RGBs or any of that stuff. It just, it's not going to work. It's not going to help me much.
Right.
What I like to do mostly is to try and see contrast. I like to see the details in, say, the Andromeda Galaxy. You know, there's that dust lane, that foreground dust lane that you can make out really easy in images, right? It comes out after a 30-second exposure. But, you know, the for the eye, it's really difficult to see. So I like to try and pick out stuff like that.
Yeah. And that contrast is something you have to do all of your post-processing for visual in the system itself before it hits your eye. You know, it has to happen there. It has to happen in the eyepiece. It's got to happen with the filters. It's got to happen everything there. All the post-processing has to be done pre-processed.
pre-processing, right?
Yeah. It all has to be done there. Whereas, you know, for imaging, and a lot of people now are comparing, like you were saying, the CMOS and CCD, and they're like, well, look how much better. Look how much more contrast. Like the CMOS chip has right out of the box compared to the CCD. And I know that, you know, for like a lot of the professionals, it's just, they kind of probably, it's like nails on a chalkboard hearing that, because you don't want, you know, contrast, right, to come directly out of the camera. You want those images to be completely flat and just have all the data possible that you can. It doesn't need to look good right out of the camera. It needs to have all of the data you can possibly have so that you can manipulate that data after the fact.
Yeah, there's a complete path. You want to know exactly what happened from the moment that photon hit the silicon chip, created an electron, which then created a count on your software. You need to keep exact track of that all the way through to your disk drive, because you want to be able to convert that photon into something physically meaningful in the sky or astronomically. And you can't, if you've got any kind of interpolating going on or guessing or figuring out of anything en route to that, you've lost data or thrown it away or corrupted it in such a way you don't really know. You can't undo what that thing did. So you don't want any of that. That's basically it.
You know, the first time I noticed this was even just for pretty picture imaging. I had an Olympus camera, which is a Micro Four Thirds, very small sensor. And then I use a Fujifilm GFX100, which is a really big 100 megapixel sensor. You know, it's much larger than full frame, even. It's medium format. And when you take the two images directly out of camera, the Micro Four Thirds image looks like it's already been processed compared to the raw data of the GFX. And it's because it just has limited dynamic range. It has all these things that make it look more contrasty and like it's already been tweaked some. But when you go in post-processing and try to manipulate the data, you find that the boundaries before the image breaks apart are very narrow compared to something like a medium format chip, where you can just push it for days and never find the boundaries because there's so much data there. And, you know, I think there's a big difference in getting that raw data in with all of the data you possibly can. You don't want it to look pre-processed right out of the camera. You want it to look flat.
Yeah. You know, when I was in London a couple of weeks ago with my wife, we went to the Maritime Museum in London, and it just coincidentally, they had an exhibit about that was an astrophotographer contest they had from people around the world. And so my wife and I went in there and looked at all the astro photos. They had the runners up and the winners and all of this. I didn't recognize any of the names except for Andrew McCarthy. Is that right? Andrew McCarthy?
Oh, yeah. He was there. Huh?
Yeah. Well, he wasn't there, but he was a winner in one of the categories. And anyway, the thing that I noticed about all of these winners, because they plaster these things, they make these big, what do you call them, gels out of them so you can shine light through them from behind. Mm-hmm. And so they mounted those on the wall. And all of the pictures that seemed to win, especially the ones for like deep sky objects and nebulae and things like that, the galaxies, had low noise. I could not see any artifacts in the noise processing after the fact. These were clearly images with lots and lots of signal. And of course, all of them had used filters, and very, very few had like pumped up their ranges or done something weird with the scaling so that you see all these noise artifacts at the end of it. We've all seen that, right? We've just pumped our images up so much that we got nothing but noise, but there was none of that. And so I really think that if you want to go to the next level, all of these images, every single one, even the Aurora images, the ones that were landscapes, spacescapes, categories, all these different categories they had, had filters on them. And so they really do up your game, I think, with a lot of this. And processing is something else that comes after all of this, but that's a topic for another day. But yeah, so get yourself a filter, folks. I mean, there's a lot to be done with it, especially if you're an imager and you want to take your game to the next level. Hopefully this episode has given you some food for thought on what to look for. And as always, you know, both Justin and I are resources. So contact OPT, contact me with any questions. We'll be happy to point you in the right direction if we don't know the answer. So, all right, man. Well, you got any plans for New Year's? You going to do anything?
You know, I never, I'm not a partier, man.
I know. It's like, I'm not either.
Yeah. We talk about it a lot, but you know, I'm a homebody that, my obsession is reading, and I found some really good philosophy books recently, so I'll probably be stuck here and you know, face down in a book most of it and just take the day easy. But those are the best kind of days, man. Sitting outside, you know, yeah, with a book, I can't beat that.
Amen, brother. You got me on that one. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, same here. Well, listen, Dustin, I wish you nothing but a prosperous 2022. You and your NOPT have come a long way, and I just wish you nothing but the best. So happy new year, my friend. And I hope, wish you nothing but success and joy.
Thank you. Yeah. Same to you.
Thank you all so much for listening. And as always, keep looking up. Space Junk is produced by Deep Astronomy and sponsored by OPT Telescopes in Carlsbad, California. Please visit our website at spacejunkpodcast.com. Also, please send any questions and comments or ideas for new episodes to spacejunk@deepastronomy.com.